Mastermind Agent is proud to present the Interview of the Month Club. Top agents, rising agents, team members, and guests from across North America reveal their success secrets, strategies, and systems in up-close and personal interviews. You can find all the club interviews at www.mastermindagent.com.
Hi, I'm Mike Cerrone with Mastermind Agent. This month's top agent is Mark Shandro with the Shandro Group in Long Beach, California. Last year, he closed 112 transactions with a total sales volume of $24 million. His average sales price was $215,000, of which 13% were buyers and 87% were sellers. He operates a team with 7 members, 3 buyer agents, 1 field agent, 1 closing manager, 1 accounting manager, and 1 team leader. Mark Shandro is the team leader of the Shandro Group. He has been an agent for 8 years. He works the Los Angeles and Orange County markets. Mark's been on a wild ride during his career. He's remained flexible and adapted to the changing markets. Mark believes you must have a diverse mix of business to survive. He covers a wide range of lead generation techniques, including bandit signs, yard signs, internet leads, referrals, sphere of influence, cold calling, door knocking, door hangers, REO, short sell, pay-per-click, email, podcasts, and videos. Mark attributes a big part of his success to coaching and masterminds. In coaching, he has been both the student and the coach. In masterminds, he's been a panelist and a moderator. Mark describes how to make these mediums pay off. Mark talks about the power of saving and investing in passive income businesses. Plus, he talks about giving back to your community through donations to charities and nonprofits. Welcome to the call, Mark.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate you inviting me to be here.
Mark, before we talk about what you're doing now, let's go back for a minute and talk about what you were doing before you got into real estate.
You know, Mike, you know, you mentioned on the top of the call, you know, I do live in Long Beach, California, beautiful, sunny Southern California, but I did not grow up here. I actually am originally from the East Coast. I went to high school and college in New Hampshire, you know, attended the University of New Hampshire and got a business degree there. And then upon graduation, you know, my wife and I, you know, packed up our car and, you know, drove west, you know, and just to kind of look for new opportunities and adventures. I was very involved in learning more about and getting involved in social change movements. So, you know, we drove around the country, spent about a month, 6 weeks doing that, and ended up landing here in Long Beach. And I actually got a job, believe it or not, my first job. First and last job ever in my life was working with Acorn. Are you familiar with Acorn, Mike?
I'm not. What is that?
You know, Acorn, they have since shut down. You know, recently they were in the media a few years ago. But Acorn is an acronym for the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. It's a grassroots-based social justice movement where my role in the organization was, and it was a brief role, you know, 6 or 8 months or so, was to, you know, go into lower-income neighborhoods such as Compton and Watts and South Central, door knock. I literally went door to door, you know, as, you know, this kind of starry-eyed white kid from New England, you know, with my nice college degree, you know, going door to door in predominantly Hispanic and black neighborhoods within LA and getting the neighborhood to organize and use organization to fight the city for better city services. You know, I don't know if you're familiar, but a gentleman by the name of Sal Alinsky, he kind of championed the idea of, you know, of social reform by, you know, the idea is that, you know, like you hear, you know, it's better to teach someone to fish than just give them fish. And, you know, that kind of, that thinking, that theory went into, you know, the idea is to, you know, get people to organize, teach them about organization and their abilities to, you know, fight the city on a group level instead of an individual and, you know, and get better city services for them. So that was my first job right out of college. You know, it was challenging at best. It was very difficult for me. You know, I was certainly a fish out of water in that experience. And then from there, I was still very interested in getting involved in community development. And from there, I went and I was, you know, for the next 8 years, I was an executive director at a national nonprofit called Bike Station that I helped co-found. And, you know, the goal of Bike Station was to go after federal, local, and state funds. So I was essentially a lobbyist to raise money to increase pedestrian bicycle transportation as an alternative to automobiles. So, you know, I've always been involved in community development and community activism, you know, and, you know, continued to do that. And I did that for about 8 years. So that's what I did. I grew the organization from, you know, just a couple of employees to, we had facilities, you know, five or so spread from Washington, D.C. to Seattle, to Long Beach and Berkeley and San Francisco. So I did that for quite a while. And then on the weekends, Mike, what I did was, you know, I bought real estate. You know, I realized that the nonprofit world was not going to provide me the financial future that I needed for a family. So on the weekends, you know, I would take my bike and I would literally ride around in neighborhoods and look for the empty houses, the one with the long weeds, the ones with, you know, the broken windows, the cars in the driveway that have been there for too long, and I would write letters to homeowners and started buying real estate and, you know, doing it that way. And that's how I kind of got into real estate.
Okay, so you slowly transitioned into real estate from an investor into a broker. What made you decide to switch from investor to broker?
That's a good question. I'm glad you asked that, Mike. After I got out of the nonprofit world, you know, I took a couple of months sabbatical. I think actually a 6-month sabbatical, continued to do some consulting, and then at that time got my real estate license. And, you know, I got my license purely on the idea of being able to get additional access to properties at a discount, you know, thinking that getting into the MLS is going to allow me to get properties at a better value. And, you know, I went to a couple of, you know, I got my license, you know, I went to Thailand for a month or so with my family, came back, got into the business again, and I signed up, you know, I kind of hung my license at Keller Williams Realty, which is, as you know, is a large international real estate company, and started taking some of their classes and realized that being an investor versus being an agent is a lot more riskier, you know. You have your capital at stake, you know, and you might make $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 on a transaction, but of course you're risking $100,000 to $200,000 in cash. I learned pretty quickly that you can make that money in sales without the risk. And also, it's much more consistent. You know, being an investor, it's very difficult to generate a consistent cash flow. You know, you're always being pressured to turn and burn stuff to generate the cash so I could feed my family. And that certainly made me very nervous. The other thing is, you know, if you can't find the right deal and you buy something at too high a price, you can certainly lose a lot of money. Or, you know, if you're pressured and you need the money, you got to sell. You might have to sell at a discount because you need your cash out. So, you know, I quickly learned that, you know, doing the real estate sales, and at the time, and this was back around 2005 or so, you know, the average sales price here in Long Beach was $450,000 to $500,000, you know, and I was making $15,000 a transaction, which was a lot of money. You know, it was a lot of money, especially when, you know, from the nonprofit world where I was used to making about $50,000 a year. And I was able to make $15,000 a transaction without any risk. So to me, it seemed really logical, and it was a challenge. You know, I was really challenged by learning how to be a salesman. It was new to me. I was challenged by learning the different personality styles. You know, I was challenged by competing against the other agents in my office. You know, I have a pretty competitive nature about me, you know, when it comes to business and you know, the kind of things that we do. I really got into it, and I excelled pretty quickly. I had that background of, you know, door knocking in South Central. So, you know, I took to the streets, and I did a tremendous amount of cold calling when I first started. I did 3 to 4 hours every single day of lead generation that was either door knocking or cold calling, really. And, you know, kind of got into that way and did really well in the beginning.
Sounds like you had a fast start.
Yeah, you know, I had a pretty quick start. You know, I was fortunate. You know, I became a pretty good top producer, you know, on a monthly basis in my office. It was a small Keller Williams office here in Bixby Knolls that's unfortunately since closed down. But, I lucked out. I kind of jumped in at a market that was really hot. As everyone was, values were jumping, 10 or 20% in a month. It was insane. There was a lot of hysteria. Of course, the biggest challenge at that point was everybody had a real estate license, I'm sure you've probably heard this joke, but, the joke in the business back then was, police officer pulls you over, they don't ask for your driver's license, they ask for your real estate license, because so many people had real estate licenses at that time.
How long have you been in the real estate business?
I'm going on about 8 years now.
How many transactions did you close last year?
Last year, I closed, 112 units, including buyer and seller sides.
You're in Long Beach, California. Where is Long Beach, California?
Long Beach is located just south of Los Angeles on the coast. Essentially, we butt up against Orange County, which is just to the south. So, my market area is, essentially 10, 15 miles outside of. Believe it or not, it encompasses probably 2 to 3 million people. It's a really large market area. The density here in the Long Beach area is really low. But, there are a lot of houses, so I do, from Long Beach to Huntington Beach to Seal Beach, those are in Orange County, up into Torrance, which is in L.A., up into Los Angeles itself, Compton, Inglewood, Linwood, Palos Verdes, San Pedro, so we have a lot of cities in our area that are very close to me within a 10 or 15 mile distance.
Describe your current real estate market.
It's changed a lot, since my business right now is predominantly bank-owned properties, we tend to be in a little bit of a lower price point, I think, from the average. My average right now is around $215,000. I don't think that's the market average. I'm sure the market average is higher, probably around the 280 mark. The good news is our days on market right now are something like 17. It's really crazy. We're getting a lot of activity. There's very low inventory right now in the market, so we're seeing tremendous amount of offers on properties. But that price point, even though it's not the $1 million price point, it turns quickly, So we're really fortunate in that we can turn a lot of volume because, that's a very active price point in terms of whether it's investors buying properties to keep as rentals or renovate and flip, or it's first-time home buyers buying into a home that, that is competitive in terms of paying rent, because it's unbelievable right now, Mike, honestly. When I was an investor, and, I still am, it was hard to find something at $100,000 a unit, but now, you can buy that stuff all day long and even less. So it's really changed since I started. I mean, it's been a night and day shift from the beginning.
Now, your overall market now, if you were to look out at your entire market, what percentage of the properties are retail sales versus REO and short sale?
Last month, again, that's a number that's changing also. Last month, out of the 100% of the sales, half of those were equity sales, 25% of those were short sales, and the other 25% were bank-owned or REO. That's different than last year. Last year, it was more, I would say it was probably about 50% were bank-owned, 25% short sale, and 25% equity. So it's really changed, and that change has happened, and we've seen that change in the last 6 months. The one thing that always surprises me, but I guess should never surprise me, is that the real estate market can change almost overnight. I mean, it's really, you think it's something that is slower because the transaction time is longer, but stuff changes quickly, and we've seen it whip around. And I think that's the key to success in this business, is that don't ever get comfortable. You've got to change with the market. You've got to constantly be adapting your marketing, your training, your techniques, your scripts, your dialogues for the market. It's always changing. It's like the ocean, It comes in and goes out. It comes in and goes out, and sometimes the tide is high, sometimes the tide is low. It's something that it's almost impossible to predict. And every time I think I got it predicted, it does exactly the opposite, of what happens. I was expecting, right now, where we are in the summer of 2012, I was really expecting a lot of REO assignments, and that has not been the case at all. It's almost all but dried up.
Do you think that the banks are making a shift from REO to emphasis on short sale?
Yeah, I don't think they're doing it. I think they're being forced to do it, but definitely, I think they are absolutely being pressured by the federal government, the state government, with the Attorney General settlement, you know, to push towards doing short sales. You know, the foreclosures are, you know, they're always going to be here, but, you know, they're not going to be like they were. You know, there's too much risk in it for the banks to continue the foreclosure, and they're constantly postponing these trustee sales. Before I got into the REO business, I did a tremendous amount of short sales. You know, I was really one of the first people in Long Beach to really take short sales. I probably even did one of the first ones of this last cycle and ran with it. I did really well. You know, 1 month I listed 19 short sales. I see myself getting back to that over the next couple of months. You know, we're starting to take a lot more of them. As the REO inventory slows down, you know, we just move over. We change gears, and I think that's one of the things that allow us to survive and thrive in this business is that you've got to predict a little bit of what's going to happen and you've got to adjust. And, you know, the short sales are becoming a lot easier, too, than they first were.
You've been able to make those adjustments, those shifts. You've been in the market for a while. In 2005, you were not doing REO and short sale. What were you doing in 2005?
2005, you know, when I first got into the business, you know, I was basically door knocking, you know, so I would go to neighborhoods and I would go door to door looking for people that were interested in either buying or selling. I was doing cold calling where I would literally go, you know, I had a sheet of paper that would go, for example, you know, one of our telephone prefixes is 562-424, and then I would just go down a page. I'd go 424-001. I call that number. 562-424-002, 003, 004, 005. And I would just go through and literally do it for hours, 5 hours a day. And it's funny, it's ironic because some of my best clients even today are those that I met making those phone calls, you know? And that's what I would do, you know? I would do, you know, I had a thing up on my wall that said, if you spend the majority of your time every day looking for new business, you will be successful. And I tried to do that. I spent the majority of my time calling and prospecting. You know, I did a lot of, you know, eventually I got into doing, you know, a lot of expired and canceled. You know, I really ramped up in that. And, you know, in 2006, 2007, you know, that represented 50%, 60% of my business.
You made a shift
to short sales.
To short sales first.
Yes. I didn't do REOs. REOs, I kind of got by accident. I started doing short sales, and I would, you know, when the market was changing, and it was around 2006, 7, you know, I think I did my first one in early 2007, and then, you know, I got on with this company called, and they're still around today, Titanium Solutions. They were really, you know, ahead of the curve in terms of doing that. I was working with them. I did one of my first short sales with a Litton loan where the, you know, the occupant got $4,000 to short sell. And, you know, and then I continued to, I had tons of bandit signs up. I mean, do you know what a bandit sign is?
What is a bandit sign?
You know, a bandit sign are those ugly yellow signs that you see all around the place that advertise anything from get rich quick schemes to, you know, mine one was I'll buy your house cash, right? And that was a lead generation tactic. Of course, the majority of people that were calling were underwater. There was no way they could sell cash if they wanted to, and I would flip them into short sales. I ran a lot of what are called Penny Saver ads. Penny Saver is a small magazine here that goes to every household, and I was running, you know, buy your home for cash sale ads. And, you know, I generated a lot of business like that. And, you know, I built up a pretty good portfolio of short sales. And this was back when, you know, my success rate in closing those was maybe 40 or 50%. It was very stressful. It was an incredibly emotional time for me and for the market and for a lot of my clients. You know, a lot of people were really unfamiliar with the real estate process in terms of getting out of underwater properties. There was a lot of stress on people. And it was hard to close transactions in any timely manner. You know, you would have 90, 120, you know, 230. I mean, it was crazy. You know, escrows would last forever because the banks were not accustomed to handling short sales. And then I realized that it was going to be impossible for me to have any kind of predictive cash flow model if I didn't diversify. I had to get out of the short sales because I was doing, you know, at that point I got into, you know, like I said, at one point I took 19 listings in 1 month. I was ranking them up, you know. But it was just very stressful. And so I looked to get into the REO business, and got my first account, and just by chance with Ocwen, made a connection with someone from India. Believe it or not, again cold calling. I would find the number to Ocwen, for example, and I knew they had 1-800-899 whatever, right? And I would go 1-800-899-1111, 1-800-899-1112. Hi, my name is Mark Shandro. I'd just like to tell you about what we do, how we can help. And I would just go through their numbers, literally calling, because you know all the companies have the same extensions, right? Same thing. And eventually I connected with some people and they started assigning me properties.
How many calls did you make before you bumped into somebody that said, yeah, we can help you out?
At that time, my goal was to make 50 new contacts every single day and get one listing or book one listing appointment every day. So I was pretty successful at that. I would, at the time, I would get one listing a day. But you got to make a lot of calls. Hundreds.
How many calls did you have to make to get 50 contacts?
About 200. It would take me about 4 hours. A good day. I mean, I didn't always get to 50. 50 was my goal. It was hard to get to 50, to talk to 50 decision makers every single day. It was very tough. But, that's what I would do, and, it's how I built my business, and, I still think the telephone, it's like this, you got to give good phone, you got to be good on the phone, and, that's the business,
Basically, you were able to dial about, 50 dials an hour, and talked about 12 people an hour.
Yeah, 12 was good, honestly, I would get to 10 usually, 8 to 10. I would track it religiously, and I was pretty committed, in the beginning, and generated a lot of business that way. And honestly, it was great. My margins were wonderful. When I ran the equity business, I was running at a 40-45% profit margin. Compared to now in the REO world, it's tough. I'm lucky to make 23-28% profit after pre-tax. After I pay myself a salary, it's not a high profit business.
Those profit margins were after you pay yourself a salary?
Yeah, after I pay myself, like $8,000 a month, not a lot.
Let's talk about your business today, and you've got a couple of niches. Describe those niches. You said REO is there. Is it still your biggest niche?
It is still my biggest niche right now. I don't see that being my biggest niche in the next 6 months. In fact, I see it almost all but disappearing. So our niches are primarily, the REO, HUD, which is part of that, which is a great client to have. It's been an amazing client for me. My team continues to do between 40 and 50 broker price opinions. They're called BPOs a month, which is great. It's great, consistent revenue. We do the short sales, of course. We have a few equity sales. And, I have a buyer team that does some transactions as well. So one of the things I've really learned in this business, and I constantly am learning it every single day, it seems like, is you gotta be diversified. It's really hard to be focused on one tight niche only and be successful every month. The business is cyclical. It goes up and down. You're cyclical. You work up and down. Everyone doesn't have the same energy every single day, every single month. And what I have found, and it's taken me about 8 years, and I still struggle with it, is I've got to have these little spokes. It's like you think of a wagon wheel, okay? And each one of those spokes is a source of business. The more spokes you have, the stronger your wagon wheel is going to be. If you're riding only on one spoke, it's not going to last very long. And I've been guilty of that. I really let a lot of my other business go while I was building a large REO business over the last 2 years. And I'm paying for that because I got to get back into the trenches now and getting back on the phone and making those calls and building the other spokes back up. Because the REO was honestly easy. It was, you wake up, you get an email. Here's a new property. You wake up, you get another one. It was it didn't require any prospecting. So, I'm really trying to build those spokes out again.
You're able to generate business from multiple methods. Let's go down a quick list of the ways that you're generating business. I'm going to come back to REO, by the way. You mentioned to us you have a couple different things. You do sign calls and IDX, Realtor.com, Dave Ramsey, Agent Machine. I'd like to talk about each of those real quickly. What are you doing to generate business by sign calls?
put up signs. Really. Again, this is something that's constantly evolving. You know, we have a couple of different signs. You know, the market's changed again. You know, whereas, you know, we, again, you know, the bandit signs that I talked about before, where I would post them all around the neighborhoods that would say, you know, I'll buy your house cash, get out in 7 days, call me. You know, we have other ones that are like the yellow ugly foreclosure signs that say, you know, foreclosures, make an offer today, 1-800 number. You know, of course, those all go into a CAL capture system. You know, we also have our regular for sale signs, you know, just the sign that, you know, is in your yard. So the great news is, you know, when you have 100 properties or so and you have 40 or so of those on the market, there's a lot of signs out there and it generates a lot of phone calls. So, you know, I actually, none of those calls come to me. Those all go to my buyer team. So those generate a tremendous amount of business for them. You know, the phones ring nonstop, and we get those call routed. They go to the agent, and then they're in a call capture system where we can go through and continue to follow up with them, you know, until whether it's a dead lead or, you know, they book an appointment.
On the sign, on your yard sign, are you putting a direct call number or a number that goes into an IVR system, an 800 number?
Yeah, 800 number.
Okay, so you don't have a direct call number or it all goes into the IVR?
All goes into the 800 number.
Okay, and so then when they get into the IVR system, they have an option to press zero, say, and get connected with your office. Is that what you mean by these calls coming into the office?
Correct. Well, yeah. Well, I can explain exactly how it works is this. We have several 800 numbers, you know. One of them is primarily focused when we market to buyers. The other one is primarily focused to when we market to short sales. The other one is primarily focused when I market to equity sellers. So, you know, an 800 number, that 800 number for buyers is on all my yard signs, you know, like the wooden ones that you see in the front yard. That number, a customer calls, 800, it goes, and then it gets directly routed to an agent, you know, and then we have a record of that call.
Are they listening to a recorded message, a pre-recorded message when they call in?
Nope.
Or is it just that you want to capture that phone number and that's why you're using the system?
Correct. Capture that phone number.
So it's a capture the phone number, but it is going directly to your agent.
Capture the phone number, goes directly to an agent, then sends an email out, you know, with that information also.
So are you also able to track the source of the call then? Are you putting any kind of extension number or identifier at the end of that 800 number?
No, we don't do any of those extensions. You know, I've found, honestly, for us, you know, and I've tried that, you know, like an Arch Telecom system or something like that. You know, for us, the management of maintaining that system has always been kind of a challenge. You know, and making sure the information is current and stuff like that. So the reality is, you know, we get so many calls, you know. We're overwhelmed with leads. You know, we almost have too many leads. We don't talk to people unless they're ready to buy or sell in the next 3 weeks, you know. And if you're not, find another Century 21 agent or somebody who can hang out with you and hold your hand for 6 months, you know. We're looking to do business today. We're not big fans of incubating a lot of leads for a long time. You know, I just go for the quick hits, you know, and that's how I've been able to grow my business to this size. You know, I'm sure we could probably double it if we had a lot of that long-term follow-up stuff, but, you know, I'm interested in making money today, this month, and next month, and I know that we can generate business, and, you know, we've been successful in doing that.
You also have 800 numbers for short sales and then equity sellers. Are those also being funneled directly to your office?
Those get funneled directly to me. So, you know, I act as pretty much the primary listing agent. You know, I rarely represent buyers. I just don't have the time for that. You know, I might have a few here and there, you know, from past clients or large hedge funds or large investors, things like that. But I almost never work with buyers. You know, I don't show property. I don't, you know, if they want to see it, they got to go look at it and then come talk to me. But the listing leads, you know, I'll jump on, you know, I get the call, I'm on it, right? 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. You know, that listing call comes in, that's my responsibility to call and convert. So our goal is to return every call within 2 minutes, you know, hopefully never. Hopefully it goes straight to a live person. And, you know, we felt that, you know, the most successful way to convert a lead is by being incredibly responsive quickly.
How do you make sure that your buyer agents are doing that? How do you make sure that they're returning those calls quickly?
Well, if they don't open escrows, they don't get paid. You know, that's really it, you know. We have two large types of leads. We have a ton of internet leads that come in, just through, you know, a lot of the internet marketing that we do. That's all free. I don't pay for really anything except realtor.com. And so we get a lot of leads like that, so they return those. And then our calls, I can look at a call log, and I can see what our average return time is. I can see what the average length of the call is. You know, so I track that stuff so that we better tune it and stuff. But for the most part, I try and get agents. You know, I've burned through a lot of buyer agents, you know, and at this point in my career, I don't bring on people that aren't hungry. So, you know, I make sure that they're hungry, and if they're hungry, they tend to work pretty well.
How are you generating calls for short sales and equity sellers?
You know, our primary marketing for short sales and equity, you know, since I'm kind of getting back into it, you know, over the last couple of months, you know, we're retooling a bunch of different things. But, you know, I run a Google pay-per-click campaign, you know, where we drive short sellers to one of my websites, which is markshander.com. You know, it gets a lot of hits. That does really well. We also have been doing a lot of the door hangers. You know, we door hang neighborhoods. That's been... You know, I'm testing that. You know, it's somewhat successful. You know, I've been getting a few calls in here. Honestly, the biggest way for me right now that's been generating short sale leads is being very in tune with my sphere of influence. And, like, whenever I get a short sale new listing, really being aggressive about asking for referrals. And that's been really successful for us, you know, getting... you do one good quality short sale, and they know four or five other people that are in a similar situation. And that's been really good for us, you know, getting out there and just promoting the referral business, you know. I've gone down the road and done a lot of the other stuff. I've door knocked, you know, of course, the notice of defaults, the notice of trustee sales, the 90-day lates. I've mailed to them. I've done a lot of that, and, you know, you end up spending a lot of money and getting a little return. Calling them, you know, it's been harder, but you know, our primary way is getting referrals out there and really focusing on generating leads through the use of good search engine optimization on our website, and of course generating leads through the pay-per-click stuff.
How are you staying in front of your sphere of influence?
The primary way that I stay in front of my sphere of influence is, you know, I run, you know, you're probably familiar with Craig Fort. You know, his newsletter, Service for Life, has been really good. I've used that for ever since I've gotten the business. You know, I send that out. That's been pretty good. You know, I also subscribe to another email server system called Happy Grasshopper, which I really like. I've been using that for the last 3 months, and it's been very good. So mostly email, you know, and of course, you know, there's a lot of social media stuff. You know, you can, you know, we were pretty active on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn. You know, I've gotten a tremendous amount of a business, you know, referral business from those, you know, and of course calling, you know, when I first started, I made a ton of calls, you know, I was very aggressive at the prospecting, and I don't do it so much anymore, to be honest. I think a lot of it's, you know, just some lazier, you know, I mean, I need to be, you know, I need to be on the phones like I used to be, but, you know, I don't do it as much, you know, I'm more interested in developing other businesses and things like that.
How frequently are you contacting your sphere of influence with the newsletter and the emails?
2 to 3 times a month. Yeah. You know, and you know, you pick really good days. You got to do Tuesday mornings. You know, I mean, you really want to be pretty strategic about it.
So you're trying to send out your emails on Tuesday mornings?
Yeah, Tuesday mornings, you know, around 9 o'clock, you know, is the best time I found for business, you know, like REO contacts. You know, sending stuff on the weekends, it just gets kind of pushed in all of their junk, you know. Any other day, on a Monday, you know, they're too involved. Every once in a while, we might do something like the 2 or 3 days right after the end of the month, you know, like the 2nd or the 3rd. You know, for bank clients, it's a good time because they're down. You know, they've already had their crazy week of the end of the month, and then, you know, we hit them after that. I try and make calls on that day. You know, if you have a first of the month like this month, where it lands on a Friday, and that's a winner. That's a great day to call, you know, so I'll hit the phones on those days.
Let's talk about a couple more of your business-generating marketing you're doing. You have VIP sites, visits. What was that? Was that what you were talking about, SEO?
Yeah, you know, exactly. We have, I think I have 3 or 4 websites, you know. We all, you know, my brother and I, who's on my team, we do a podcast that we push out called livinglongbeach.com. It's interesting, you know, and I do a lot of videos. I have over 180 I think 180 or 170 YouTube videos, do a lot of videos. You know, I've really, you know, jumped into that area That works really well. What's interesting, though, is a lot of that stuff, it doesn't necessarily generate new leads, but what it does is when you have a lead or you direct them to that, they become much more familiar with you, and then when you go to the appointment, it's a lot easier to close. The videos are great for that, so is a podcast. The podcast establishes you as a local expert, and people like that. But when they see you on video and they see your stuff and they see whatever you're talking about, whether you're showing a house or whether you're talking about a short sale process or whatever, they become familiar with you, and it's a lot easier when you go to meet that person. They almost kind of know you. It's weird. It's kind of odd for me because you show up and they're already like, they're already like, oh, hey, yeah, I saw this, I liked it, funny, whatever. And it's a great way to break the ice, and, it gets that familiarity.
This podcast, how often are you doing it?
We go in waves, but right now we're up once a month. We bring in last episode was just about short sales, and now right now it could not be a better time to do a short sale. In fact, it's probably the best time in anyone's over the next couple of years because of the 2007 Mortgage Debt Relief Act that's expiring at the end of the year. We also bring in title people. For the next couple of months, I have hard money lenders scheduled to speak about lending to investors and also to lending to people that have gone through short sales. We're developing a short sale financing program, so if you've had a short sale in the last couple of years, you can use some non-traditional financing. We also meet with people that are talking about rebuilding your credit, debt consolidation, title. I think I mentioned the title. We try and bring in relevant people from the industry, but we also keep it very localized. We go over the numbers, what are the sales for the previous month, what's the trending, things like that.
The podcast, how are you pushing it out? Are you just putting it up on your website or using iTunes? How are you getting it out there in the market?
Yeah, absolutely. It goes, we have a dedicated website just for that, and it links to, we just started doing it this past month. We're doing both audio and the video version. So we record it, and then we post it, of course, through iTunes, and then we also put the video up on YouTube, and we push it out. And of course, I have all our sites. I mean, it's great. Nowadays, I mean, it's amazing with WordPress. I mean, it's just an incredible piece of software. You put it on WordPress, and if you have it set up right, it pretty much blasts already to all the social networking that we do, social marketing.
Now, YouTube, do you have a channel on YouTube?
Yeah, I think it's Mark Shandro. Yep.
So people could go there and take a look.
Yeah, absolutely. Go to, type in Mark Shandro and you'll see all our, all our videos. I do, one of the videos, it's kind of funny, one of the videos, and I recommend everyone does this. I mean, the video for me that has been one of the most successful videos I've done, and I need to continue to do more, and I just haven't had a chance, is, I used to have a little 50cc scooter mic, the little Honda scooters. And what I would do is get up early in the morning around 7 o'clock on a nice sunny day, take my camera, and I drive around the neighborhood, And, I drive around Bixby Knolls, which is where I live, in Long Beach, film that. And, you give people kind of a bird's eye view of what the neighborhood looks like, what some of the houses are, what the commercial areas are like, and then I post that. And people are very responsive. They like that. They like to see, that they know now that I'm here, I'm local, I know the neighborhood, I'm in the area. And that one gets a tremendous amount of hits. People really like that. And we also do, of course, all the houses. Almost every listing that we have, probably 70% of them, we do a one take, one shot, no editing, minute and a half to 2 minute video, 2 minute walkthrough video of the house. Those are of course very popular as well. Because then you can post them everywhere. It's easy to push those out there, and they're better than photos. It doesn't have to be perfect, but it gives people an idea. What we tend to do is, we're very honest. We're very, this thing has got mold. This thing looks like junk. This one's got broken. It's got a broken faucet. And really kind of point out the, of course you point out all the positives and the benefits, but also point out some of the negatives, I mean, they're obvious, the things aren't, you can't hide, right? So you might as well, make it obvious that these are issues. And I think you get a lot more trust that way.
Back to lead generation, you had Dave Ramsey on the list. What is that?
Yeah, Dave Ramsey for us has been a great source of business over the last, 12 months or so. You know, Dave Ramsey is a radio talk show host out of Tennessee, and he's written several books as well. He's an author, best-selling author. He wrote a book called Money Makeover. And, you know, he has a syndicated radio show that's just coming here to California, and he has a network called ELPs, you know, and the ELP, I think it's, I'm not sure what the acronym stands for, but, what you can do is you can apply to become an ELP within his network, and what happens is, you know, Dave Ramsey is, you know, he promotes, financial stability. That's really his message, you know, getting out of debt, owning your house, paying it off. And then he's just got this thing called baby steps, which is, you know, a process to become financially independent. And I'm a big believer of being financially independent, you know. I don't have a lot of debt. I try and save 20, 30% of my income every single month. And really growing wealth that way. And he has a lot of followers that do the same thing. So, you know, and if you become part of his network, he sends you referrals where people that are looking to buy or sell real estate in your market. And it's competitive. You know, the referral will go out to 3 agents. But again, the game for this one is easy. It's first to make the call. You know, I mean, from my experience, the first person to contact that buyer or seller is going to win that contract. So he's been a great source of business for us. You know, obviously we pay a referral fee. I think it's 29%, something like that. But they tend to be higher-end sellers, people that are very liquid, that have a lot of capital, that are also trying to, you know, either, you know, get to the point where they want to be financially independent as well. So that's been a great partnership for us.
Did you have to pay a fee or do an application to get on that list, on that referral list?
Yes, it's free. I don't think there's a fee. I don't remember, but it is an application process, and it's based on, you know, the availability of leads in the marketplace. But it's great. It's also like, you know, I mentioned another one we spoke about earlier, Mike, is Agent Machine, similar type website. It's a little bit more SEO generated, where, you know, people put in their information, and that lead will go out to a couple of agents, and they, you know, you have an opportunity to interview, and they tend to be very, very good qualified leads, people that are sophisticated, people that are looking for someone who really knows what they're doing, and who has a good presentation.
Agent Machine, did you also fill out an application or pay a fee to get into that system?
Correct. You fill out an application, there's no fee that I know of, and it's just a referral, again, a referral basis.
Do you remember how much that referral fee is?
You know, I think it's 25%.
Those two sources of business, how many transactions do you think that you're generating from them, say, either monthly or annually?
We generate about one each monthly. I mean, it's not huge.
So one a month each?
Yeah, you know. I mean, again, we have so many inbound calls that, you know, that's the best way for us so far. The inbound calls really dwarfs everything else.
I want to talk about one of your areas of expertise, that's the REO business. You have a unique perspective on REO. You not only list REO properties, you're also teaching other agents how to list REO. So I think you're going to bring a wealth of information in to this conversation. Let's just start talking about your current REO business. How many banks and asset managers are you working with?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, one time it was up to about 25 or 30 different clients. You know, I think right now, you know, the industry has heavily consolidated. You know, a lot of them have gone out of business. A lot of them have been purchased by other companies. You know, I think we're down to about 5, you know, that are consistently giving us business. So it's not nearly as many as it used to be, but, you know, from those 5, we get a pretty good amount, you know. And again, December of last year, I got 19. November of last year, I got like 18. We were getting, on average, almost every single month, 15 new assignments every month. However, the new year, you know, it's really changed. You know, that business is not like it used to be. Now it's more like 5 or 8 a month.
These 5 that you're working with, are they all private banks? Are you also working with government entities?
No, I work with a combination of both. You have servicers, which are like, you know, the Bank of Americas of the world and the Citibanks, you know, which actually service, or NationStar, which actually services the loan. And then when that property goes into default, they manage the disposition of the REO. And then you have other companies that are called outsourcers, which are like, you know, the LPSs of the world, the Green River Capital, things like that, where, you know, Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae or any other servicer would hire that company to, you know, when the property goes REO, they'll hand over that property to this outsourcer, and then the outsourcer will then hire us. So we have a few of those. And then, you know, one of my biggest accounts is HUD, which is, those are homes that have had an FHA loan on them. And then when that FHA loan goes into default, let's say, for example, Bank of America is servicing that FHA mortgage, the FHA-insured mortgage, when that property goes REO, Bank of America turns around then and they go to HUD and they cash in their insurance claim. And HUD takes the home and then pays Bank of America the insurance claim. And then what HUD does is HUD hires a third-party outsourcer. And in my case, here in the state of California, there are two. There's PEMCO and then there's BLB Resources. BLB Resources is my client. And then BLB Resources assigns that property to us and then we sell it. What's great about HUD is that a lot of things. Number one is they pay a full 6% commission, which is becoming increasingly rare, if not absolutely absent in the REO world. You know, my average commissions on the listing side for REOs right now is about 1.6%, whereas HUD pays 3% or 6% for, you know, for both sides. The other great thing is when you get the property assigned to you, Mike, it's assigned to you completely vacant. It's ready to go to market. It's going to be on the market in 2 weeks. Unlike a lot of properties that I have from some of these other big servicers where I've literally had them for 2 years, you know, where we've been doing weekly inspections. We've been, you know, and that's because we're trying to vacate the property. And the occupant is challenging the, whether they're challenging the foreclosure, they're challenging the eviction, they're filing for bankruptcy. It's a highly labor-intensive process. So, but, you know, it's great right now because the market is so tight when you get those properties on the market. You know, they sell almost immediately.
You're doing your HUD account through these outsourcers. It's not a direct account with HUD. If you were to look at your overall business, say, in the last 6 months or last 12 months, what percentage of your REO business is HUD?
HUD represents about 33%, 35% of my REO business. In terms of income.
Are you also working with either Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac?
Not directly. You know, I get some Fannie Mae properties through outsourcers. You know, Fannie Mae, you know, they have both internal, where they sell them internally, and then they outsource them. But that's going away. That'll be gone probably, I would imagine. You know, they went right just recently, Mike, they went through a round and they got rid of a lot of their outsourcers. They only have 3 outsourcers left in the whole United States. Where at one time, I think they had 16.
I'm sorry, when you say they, did you mean Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac or HUD?
Fannie Mae. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, Fannie Mae. Freddie Mac works with 3 outsourcers. Freddie Mac works with, you know, they work with Green River Capital, which is a big one of my biggest clients. They work with a company called VRM. And they have one more that I can't quite think of. And then Fannie Mae, they outsource to, actually Green River Capital Austin, they outsource to 24 Asset Management, Equity Point, and one other one. And I forget what that is as well at the moment. They've all reduced, you know, because of their inventory has really shrunk. They've gotten rid of a lot of the outsourcers.
Sounds like the REO market, although it's still active in your area, 25% of the closings, is on a downward trend right now. Would you recommend that anybody try to get into the REO business today?
I do, and the reason is, Mike, is that it's, you know, I don't think it's difficult to make that your entire source of business, but it's a great base. I recommend everyone gets into BPOs, definitely. Absolutely, you know. I mean, that's a little bit component of it, you know, the broker price opinion, the evaluations. Highly recommend. I think every agent should really be doing that. It's a great source of consistent income on a monthly basis. And then also it keeps you really in tune with the market and pricing. You know, like I said, on average we're doing about it's about $2,000 a month in income on the BPO side. The REO side is shrinking. The good news is that, you know, I think it'll always be here, you know, unlike where it disappeared a few years ago. I think it's always going to be around for the next 10, 20 years. I also expect it to pick up again towards the end of the year. I think once the elections are over, once, you know, the Attorney General settlement has kind of flushed itself out, they've spent all that, you know, $35 billion, I think REOs will come back at a fury. So I do think it's a good time. I think it's also something to just keep your fingers in and not expect to build your business 100% on it.
Now, you mentioned that your market is changing. There's more equity sales. Is that because your prices are moving up again in your market?
No. I mean, the prices are definitely moving up slightly. You know, we're having appraisal issues, which I think, you know, you've seen in the news a lot lately. But I think that the reason that it's they're becoming more part of the market is I think people realize that, you know, now they need to, the market is probably not going to substantially change in terms of going up in big value over the next few years, and there are people are making a move now. The other thing is, you know, we get, you know, people die. A lot of people die, right? And, you know, as last I checked, you can't take your house with you. So, believe it or not, we do quite a few of those transactions, you know, where people have passed away and family members inherited the house, and you know, they don't have a need for it, and they've owned it free and clear, and they want to cash out, you know, especially now with the possibility of taxes really going up over the next couple of years. I think people are realizing that now, if you need to make a real estate move, yeah, I don't think you can find a better time. This is it. You know, in the next 3 or 4 months, this is it. Who knows what's going to happen after the election?
If somebody wanted to get into the REO business now and were not currently in the business, how would you advise them to break into the REO business?
Yeah, I do think there's a lot of opportunities in the REO business, you know, for a lot of different reasons. Number one is you have a lot of legacy brokers that have been around a really long time that do a large chunk of the business, and I think that clients are starting to pull away from them. Their quality is not as good as some smaller and, you know, more nimble firms like myself, where we can provide a much higher level of service. The other reason is, you know, people get fired all the time. You know, the demands on an REO agent are getting harder and harder, and they're always getting rid of agents, you know, and they're bringing on new brokers. So I think it's great to be in there with that, you know. The other thing is, you know, there's a big movement now, especially with, you know, a lot of the large servicers like Bank of America, like Chase, like NationStar Mortgage, where they're looking to you to generate new loan origination business for them. I'm always a big fan of relationships that are mutually beneficial. You know, if I can work on a way to generate new business for example, new loans and stuff for a Chase or a Bank of America, and then in turn they're going to help me with my REO business, it's a better cycle. And I think, again, a lot of these legacy brokers aren't set up to do that. They don't have the buyer agent teams organized like that really understand the importance of generating new business for the servicer. The other thing is it's always going to be around. There's always going to be 7 or 10% foreclosures, you know. I doubt we're going to go through a period like I did when I first got into business where there was absolutely no REO. There's always going to be it. And the other thing is it's great to get in with local banks. You know, there's a lot of local banks in your marketplace that need local agents to help them, you know, with the REO business. So to answer your question about how to get into it, really, it's a prospecting thing. Just like, you know, when I talked about earlier, you've got to get out there, you've got to apply to these companies, you've got to send them your resume, and you need to talk to them and you need to explain to them why you're better than your competitor. They're not so much interested now in the fact that you sold 200 homes last year. They're more interested in the fact that you're going to give them an accurate BPO value, that you're going to make sure the property doesn't get vandalized. You're going to make sure that the property is marketed like a regular traditional property. They're going to make sure that you generate new loan applications for them. So I think it's now more than ever easier to get in the REO world because of that than it was a few years ago.
An agent trying to get an REO, would they just go direct to the bank today? Is that the best way to do it? And if so, how do they figure out who to call first?
Yes, absolutely. They go direct to the servicer or the outsourcer, you know. I mean, you know, almost every single servicer has, you know, I mean, of course, there's some internal information, you know, where to get the application, but they almost all have online applications available. The difference, what I like about REO, which really is one of the reasons I think I did really well and was attracted to it, you know, because it kind of fits in with my lobbying background. It's more business to business, you know. It's not, you know, you're not sitting down at a dining room table with a seller and kind of, you know, meeting with them at, you know, 11 o'clock on a Saturday morning. You know, it's a 9-to-5 business, essentially. And what you, you know, what you do is, you know, you submit your application, you find out who the vendor manager is, which is, you know, typically the person that manages the agent network, and you make a connection with that person. And then hopefully once, you know, you get accepted into their network, and then the next step is, you know, trying to get the assignments and following up with, you know, we do a lot of handwritten letters. I do a lot of, you know, obviously phone calls. I have a lot of them with Facebook friends and LinkedIn, things like that, you know. And, you know, you just, it's like, in a lot of ways, it's like regular real estate where, you know, a lot of it's follow-up.
You said there's been a reduction in the number of outsourcers. How does someone figure out who the dominant outsourcers are in their area?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, one of the things that when I first started, I was, you know, I have a subscription to is, you know, I think it's maybe only on the West Coast, Mike, but it's a website called foreclosureradar.com. And Foreclosure Radar is, you know, a website that allows you to track notice of defaults and notice of trustee sales, which is through the foreclosure process, and who the servicer is. So, you know, if I was, let's say I was located in an area where, you know, I wanted to get into the REO business, you know, the first thing I would do is I would find out who the big REO agents are, right? And then I would look at their listings. And then I would look at who owns their listings. And then I would find out what banks they're working with, you know. And then what I would do is then I would target those banks, you know. I would target those banks and, you know, apply to those and make sure you're going after the banks and the servicers that are actually selling and have inventory in your marketplace. I mean, it doesn't make sense to get into a company that doesn't do business in your neighborhood, you know, because you're never going to get a listing. But a lot of it's just kind of grunt work research, you know. Obviously, like, you know, you'd mentioned, you know, I work with Harris Real Estate University, and, you know, we do a lot of coaching. We also publish a lot of the lists that have the websites where to sign up for what servicers and things like that. So, you know, getting a hold of something like that, obviously, is helpful, you know, knowing, you know, having a kind of a matrix of servicers and their websites and their decision makers, so that helps. You know, of course, there are also industry events. You know, there's a lot of industry events that happen on a national level as well as they happen on a local level. And I recommend all agents get involved. And there are two great organizations that I highly recommend, and I really support their missions. One is ARIA, which is, I believe it's the Asian Association of Real Estate Professionals, something like that. The other one is NAREP, National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals. Both of those organizations, they have a lot of local chapters, and, you know, they have local events too. You know, with for $50 or $100, you can go to, you know, a local event in your area where you can drive to, and they almost always have asset managers and servicers at those events. And it's a great inexpensive way for you to meet some of these asset managers face-to-face, shake their hand, and get a better understanding of exactly what they're looking for.
For these two organizations you just mentioned, you said Asian and Hispanic. Do you have to be of Asian or Hispanic descent in order to attend these meetings?
No, not at all. Good question. Not at all. No, you don't. You know, they're open to anybody that's a real estate professional, and you know, they're, you know, I don't want to speak for them, but, you know, I understand their mission is to increase awareness in these underserved minority communities about how real estate works and the opportunities that are available to them. You know, they're education based. They also do some national lobbying, you know, on the national front to you know, support funding in these areas as well.
Because the word Asian and Hispanic are in there, is that referring to the markets they're trying to serve or the agents that they're trying to help?
I believe it's the markets they're serving.
Are there other industry trade conferences and so forth that you would recommend people go to?
You know, there are quite a few of them, actually. You know, I don't know if I would recommend going to them until you're at a certain level of production, you know, because they can get expensive. You know, I just came back from one in Dallas a couple of weeks ago, and that was called REO Expo, and that was put on by, I believe it's DS News, which is a, you know, again, an industry publication where they, you know, this default servicing news, and that's in Fort Worth, which is great. You know, you can go to events like that. There's REOMAC, which is another industry organization where they have conferences in Florida and here in Palm Springs. There's also Five Star, which is in Texas as well. I mean, there are quite a few of them. You know, larger ones. You know, that happen. You know, they might have between 1,000 and literally 5,000 real estate professionals attending. They get expensive, though. You know, I mean, you're going to spend $2,000 or $3,000 getting there and attending and paying for the admittance and things like that. But it's a great way. You know, when I first got into the REO business, Mike, you know, I had a $45,000 travel budget. You know, and I did a lot of traveling. You know, and I did a combination of going to these events, but what I did primarily was going straight to clients' offices. You know, and meeting with the clients, having sit-downs, you know, going out to dinner, going out to lunch, really getting to know the business that way. I think now, I don't know if that's necessary in today's market. You know, the REO business is much more evolved, and it's a lot less kind of good old boys network than it was. So breaking in is a little bit easier, and it's not as locked down. And again, you know, everyone that we're talking about, you know, they all have scorecards. They all rate you on your performance, and a lot of it's heavily performance-based.
This is the end of part one. The interview continues on part two.